Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Whiskey Congress. You have Steve here and Jim, and we have a special guest, Benjamin Eves. Ben is from the podcast Whiskey Den. They talk about whiskey, if you couldn't figure that out. Ben has interacted with us on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook. We've come to actually work together. Ben and I do a roundtable session that we put on Facebook Live on Thursdays, where we talk more just about social injustice, racial issues, more specifically and amongst a diverse group, just to sort of kind of see where different people are. And we try to really focus on solutions as opposed to just kind of regurgitating a lot of the stuff that we're hearing in the news. So over that time, I've grown to appreciate Ben's perspective. He's a guy from the South, and so he sees things a little bit differently than we do. But oddly enough, there's plenty that we agree upon. Ben is a former Republican, and now would identify as a libertarian. He is an interesting guy, to say the least. So, Ben, welcome.
Hey guys, welcome. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Thanks for being on. Then we have Jim. Most people listening to the show, you know Jim very well. He is a bleeding heart liberal.
I wouldn't go that far, but okay.
But he's a little bit different than most liberals, but he's got strong opinions, as you know. And this is really more about Ben and Jim sort of kind of talking about their differences and where they come out. Some of it may be similar, some of it may be very different. I am more of the role of moderator and maybe partially antagonist, depending on my mood. I will be the middleman tonight to try to keep the peace. But gentlemen, let's get started. I think we're gonna start off broad and kind of narrow the topics down as we go. But the first one, I wanna pitch it to you, Ben, with the role of government. Following you on social media, you have some very specific stances on government and taxes and taxation. So let's start with you and just your overall, just give us your philosophy on the role of government.
Basically, I come in from that viewpoint, a constitutionalist, if you will. I think the Constitution, as laid out, is defined to limit government. Very much. And so I see government's role very limited. And personally, for me, I want to see it limited because my philosophy is just leave me the hell alone, basically. If you can understand that, it's the more I see government interfering with individual rights and dictating to me how I need to live my life, basically, the more I see problems. And so basically, I see government kind of as it was laid out foundationally here in the U.S., provide for the defense, provide roads for postal delivery, provide a judicial system. They're there to collect taxes. I've got my opinions on that. But, I see a very limited role for government. I think, obviously, as we've progressed in society and technology and other things have gone, sure, we've seen, perhaps the need for the expansion of government in certain areas, but my tendency is that it goes too far most often. And honestly, my take on government is I don't ever see it doing things very well, regardless of what it does. And there's a propensity, I guess, if you go back there, there's the way I see it is government as an agency is about power and authority. And when you're dealing with human nature, whether it's a socialist government, a communist government, a Republican government, a Democratic government, whatever style you have, there's a tendency for human nature just to get corrupt and to want to abuse power and take that for their own personal betterment. And I've yet to see throughout history where that's proven wrong, quite honestly. And even, you know, today with our government here in the U.S., you start digging into the levels of corruption there and the abuses of power. And, you know, I could sit here and go all night about that kind of stuff. So really my preference is to see a more limited role in government in things. I'm a free market capitalist, you know, let the market decide. Basically, the less government has its hands tinkering in that, in my opinion, the better. Sure, I agree with breaking up monopolies and, you know, kind of managing certain aspects of that. But in general, I'd prefer to see the free market decide how things roll in regards to that. So the more government can keep hands off, my take is the better, because it's, you know, hey, leave me alone and I'm going to leave you alone kind of thing. That's my general take on it, but you know, obviously there's exceptions and it can be a situation by situation thing, but that's kind of my general philosophy.
Jim, why don't you jump in? What are your thoughts on the role of government there?
So Ben, first of all, thank you for coming on. Yep. I'm glad we get to talk, because we really don't know each other that well. We've interacted a bit, but you and I would publicly state we have different views. And we don't have a long-term history of interacting. So this is a chance for two people who obviously think about these sorts of things to converse. And so, again, thank you. I understand everything you just said, and I wouldn't disagree necessarily. Now, I would say one misconception that I go nuts about is the notion that private industry does things well. Most of my career has been based on how screwed up private industry is. And there is some government interaction. I've worked most of my career in pharmaceutical manufacturing. And when you see how badly private industry manages some things, it is amazing and borderline entertaining. But I understand a lot of your points and wouldn't argue strongly against them, other than to say that we need some sort of governance. We need some sort of common understanding. And corruption is a huge thing. And I, like I said, you identify as libertarian. And one of the reasons I respect you is I hear a lot of people call themselves libertarians. And I will point at celebrities like Bill Maher and Alex Jones, who both call themselves libertarians. And I call bullshit on both of them, because they're just ducking from, I don't want to be a liberal, I don't want to be a Republican or conservative. And you self-identify as saying that you were a Republican and said they abandoned the ideals that you joined them for and walked away from it. And I completely respect that. But I, done right, government, especially in the modern world where there's just so much connection between humans on every level, I think that we can no longer be necessarily local or state, even. We are now a national government or international government. And I just said international, which makes me a globalist. So Alex Jones's head would explode if he gave a fuck who I was. But but I do think that there is
clapping for yourself. That's when you know it's good.
No, but I do think that just the world has changed and evolved, and I agree that corruption is easy to evolve, and so much of our government, and if you go into foreign governments, I mean, look at Russia, look at China, fuck's sake, corruption is everywhere. So yeah. I'm all about fighting corruption. However, I do think that government does not play a negative role if done right, and if you put the finger back at me and say, give me an example of when it was done right, I'll let you know when I get one.
that would be my response.
So I guess, you know, but going back to that, I mean, obviously our government has evolved and it is bloated over time, whether it's national, state, or municipal. And if you go back in time, I mean, you go all the way back to the days of the gold rush. I mean, corruption was you know, in your face with, you know, payments here and, you know, quid pro quo and all those sort of things. So, I mean, corruption's always been a part of government. Whenever you have power and access to power, then corruption is right behind it.
Sure.
You know? So, I don't know if there's any really appropriate level of government where you could say this type of government will reduce the amount of corruption that's there, right? But maybe by limiting the role, you limit the damage that the corruption can do.
And if go ahead, Ben.
I was going to say, I completely agree with you on that, because honestly, if you look at every human institution, whether it's religion or government, businesses, especially up to corporation level, you're going to have, human nature and greed and power and corruption that comes into influence. And this may tie in with a later topic, but the way I see the formation of the government in the United States, when it was formed, it was with the intention that it's a servant of the people, right?
Okay. Yes, absolutely.
And that's one of the things I have a problem with, especially on with my conservative friends, is typically a viewpoint of, you know, we respect authority and we respect those in charge and we respect our leaders. As a church guy, I hear this a lot. Okay. Well, my pushback on that is, but wait a second, the U.S. is set up, the president is actually supposed to be a servant of the people, right? Not the other way around.
Agreed.
But that's how we hold it. So our government was formed with the intention, and this is the whole purpose. If you go back and look at the founders' intents, the whole purpose of the Second Amendment was for the people to be able to overthrow the government when they got tired of it. If they felt it became onerous, if they felt it became too tyrannical, that's the whole point for the establishment, you know, the right to bear arms and establishment of a militia. Well, what is a militia? That's not a standing army. That's an army of the people, because our founders actually feared a standing army when they formed this government. That's why we didn't have one basically until after 1812 and they formed the Navy. But so the larger government grows and you get to the largesse that we have today, it almost becomes virtually impossible to rein in. And that's part of the problem I have, is with continuing to see government grow, you continue to see corruption spread to the level. It's like tentacles of an octopus. How do you begin to untangle all this mess, really? And so to entrust government to program after program after program, I start to push back and go, whoa, can we get some actual accountability, and can we start to clean this up in a way before I start to entrust you with more tax dollars or running this program or running this program or running this program? Personally, I'd like to see you get your hands out of all of it. But, you know, I'm also a realist with this. I'm an idealist, but I'm a realist. Like, idealistically, hey man, sign me up for anarcho-capitalism. You know, that sounds wonderful. Or sign me up for, you know, perfectly run socialism. Let's have a utopia. That sounds great. But I'm also a realist. The reality is none of those effectively deal with human nature. And human nature is what it is. And that's why you see, even where they've tried to push for communism or socialism or any other type of utopian type place, you can never counteract human nature. And it always ends up corrupted, and it always ends up doing something wrong or doing something very bad in the places, in the case of places where it's really gone bad. You know, you look at former USSR or Cambodia or anywhere else across the world, people come into power, they take over, they abuse that power, and the people pay for it. And so my ideal or my goal is to limit as much power and authority that government has. You know, Jim, you said basically you've seen how businesses can run things poorly as well. And I agree, because again, you're dealing with another institution of humanity. But I guess my question is, who has the power to do greater harm, businesses or government?
Okay, fair point, because you could easily argue that businesses will self-govern, for lack of a better word, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't do the job. And most of my career has been in pharmaceutical manufacturing, which is a government-regulated industry, And so I kind of get to see the mesh of those two, where the government gets involved, but industry makes their decisions. And the level of stupidity I've seen is remarkable. I'm not going to sit here and tell stories right now. If you want to do it sometime, I'm all for it. I'll just need more whiskey. But it's amazing how badly private industry will trip all over itself. Having said that, there's a lot of validity to what you say. And I do want to talk to you about, you kind of jumped into the Second Amendment issue. Mm-hmm. We talked about, I have a shotgun right over my right shoulder. I'm a gun guy. So as a bleeding heart liberal, I'm a pro-life, pro-gun, avid hunter who needs to get out in the woods more, and I'm mad at myself about that. So I'm a weird liberal. But the reality is right now, the government's capabilities exceed the average individual's by a ton. Having said that, that doesn't mean we shouldn't protect ourselves. I mean, I hate dumb arguments. And one of my favorite dumb arguments to fight against is to say, well, as a citizen, you can't compete with a nuclear bomb. No shit. No one said you could. But there's government entities that could intrude upon our freedoms, where the shotgun sitting behind me, which was state-of-the-art when Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp walked down to the OK Corral, actually stuff above that, but whatever, that could protect me in a lot of situations. And my right to have that is, to me, huge, because if a local authority wanted to, take me down, that would be enough for me to say, don't come in my door. Now I'm getting a bit weird and a bit aggressive. But, literally, I'm just trying to shoot down the argument that, well, you can't beat a drone, you can't beat a nuclear bomb, you can't beat a tank. You're right. But that thing behind you right now, which is literally hundreds of years old technology, does make my house safer for me. And I am all for that aspect of the Second Amendment. Now, I want to talk to you about this because I have been open to finger quoting gun control measures for years. And then the state of New York under Governor Andrew Cuomo issued the SAFE Act, or Safety Act, I forget what it's called. It is the dumbest law I've ever seen. And there's actually a lot of things that Andrew Cuomo has done during the COVID situation that I respect him for, but that law was so fucking stupid. And it destroyed me personally, because I would talk to friends and family members who were avid Second Amendment people, and they would tell me the government's coming after your guns, and I would say, you're being silly. No, this isn't happening. No one's going to try to take away your slingshot. And that dumbass fucking law came through, and I was like, all right, it didn't take away your slingshot, but it included one provision that I will point out, and there are others that I could if you want, but one of them was, you can't have a magazine that holds over 10 rounds. And Glock said, we're not going to sell 8-round magazines or 7-round magazines, so no Glocks in New York. And then New York changed the law to say, you can have a 10-round magazine, but you can only put 7 rounds in it. I'm like, that is the dumbest law I have ever fucking heard. It just is so disconnected. And what I wanted to argue against the slippery slope arguments, that stupid thing that Andrew Cuomo put into place chopped my knees up. I couldn't say no one will ever do this, something this dumb, and then Andrew Cuomo did. And so as a Second Amendment guy, I just kind of took a knee, so to speak. Yeah. I'm sure I've lived in South Carolina. South Carolina is very open when it comes to gun laws. My gun range didn't have air conditioning, so I hated that aspect, because sweating through my shirt after 5 minutes of shooting was an issue. But it was a state that allowed me to go out to. They had public outdoor ranges I would go to and shoot at, and getting a concealed carry permit was pretty easy. And I'm all for all those things. And when these stupid fucking laws get put into place in a state as big as New York, I just get so frustrated, because I'm all for saying the dumb, we're going to take this away from you shit will never happen, and then it did. and I'm going to slap.
Ben, so let me ask you a question. Yeah. What are your thoughts on some of the gun control measures that are put out there, because it ties directly into the role of government? And so you hear things, Jim was talking about, you can only put 7 rounds in a 10 round magazine or a clip. So I guess, where do you come out on some of these, they call them sensible gun laws? Do you support them, or do you feel that those are all, the government overstepping their bounds?
Yeah, I completely feel it's government overstepping their bounds. I mean, I'm totally with you, Jim. I'm a huge gun guy. I love, my hobbies are precision, long range shooting, hunting, handguns, down to air rifles. I love it all. And I have since I was little. I mean, I used to go to my grandfather's when I was born. He bought me a .22 rifle. And when I was 3 years old and I couldn't even hold the gun up, he would hold it and let me pull the trigger, out in the yard shooting at targets, because I've just been hooked on the whole shooting and precision. I love everything about it. But from a government standpoint, again, I get back to original intent. The Bill of Rights is shall not be infringed. The right to own shall not be infringed. In my opinion, any law you pass is an infringement. When you have an ingrained Bill of Rights and you start to infringe on one of those, again, it's that slippery slope. Well, where do you stop? So do we start to infringe on the practice of religion? Do we start to infringe more on free speech and on down the line? So, yeah, I do have a problem with it, because the reality is I don't think, and if you start digging into the laws, you start digging into the statistics, I don't think it really makes us any safer one way or the other. Whether you go back to the old NFA Act, that basically outlawed machine guns and suppressors and all those things, you have to jump through mega hoops to be able to own one, depending on your state, even. So some people have argued that, we'd be like the Wild West. And honestly, all the digging and looking into it I have, I really don't think it would change very much, because you're not changing criminal activity. Criminals are going to do what they're going to do. And if you look at all the laws that have been passed, what have most of them actually done to stop a crime? Or to stop it from happening? And, so just like limiting the magazine to 10 rounds, okay? Number one, you can go to one argument where, like I was saying, basically the original intent was for Americans to be able to, if you get tired of your government and you feel like it's too tyrannical, you're to overthrow it. That's the whole point of the Second Amendment, was government was to fear the citizenry, not the other way around. But obviously with the whole military-industrial complex since World War II, the way things have grown and advanced technologically, I've heard the argument that, we couldn't stand a chance against tanks and airplanes and all the tech that they have now. True, but then I look at Iraq and Afghanistan recently, and you've got, civilians with AKs who the guns don't even shoot straight. And, we've had an ongoing battle there. Sure, we've had battles we've won. The military's done great. But at the same time, we haven't been able to completely stop it either. And then go back and look at a guerrilla warfare in Vietnam and what happened there, and translate that to the U.S. Just huge ifs here. If a civil war were to break out, or if a new revolution broke out, my question is how much of the military would side with the government and how much would side with the people?
That's pretty.
That's something you've got to think about. And most of the veterans and a lot of people that I have personally talked to and I've read interviews with said they would not side with government if government turned against people here. And so that's something you have to consider as well. But then, heck, even for hunting, I've had friends of mine push me about going in the woods with I had a SIG, a rifle that was chambered in 7.62x39, an AK round, sure, and used it for, it was excellent for hog and deer hunting down here. Now, what are you doing hunting with a 30 round magazine? Have you ever walked in the woods and had a pack of boar come up on you? You're going to want all 30 rounds, because sometimes those packs can be pretty large and they'll run you up a tree quick. So, even for the hunting argument, it's depending on where you're at, it's legit.
I would fight you on that, because I've hunted since I was 16 and I've never had to fire more than 3 shots. Yeah. But truthfully, I've never hog hunted in South Carolina, so I'll throw a bone that way.
That's a different ball game. Yeah,
I'm
and
sure it
you
is.
Don't even have to be hog hunting. You can just be deer hunting or out, you know, squirrel hunting or whatever, and here they come. And now you've either got to figure out how to get up a tree or get away pretty quick.
The boar situation in Texas is so bad that they actually take people up in helicopters with, you know, AR-15s and you know, heavier artillery to shoot them, because boars in Texas are literally a menace. And you know, I mean, they're really dangerous animals. There was a woman not too long ago that was attacked by a pack of wild boars, and they basically ate her to death.
Yep.
And you know, so they're you know, it's not that I want to derail the conversation, but I mean, there are definitely arguments for a more aggressive style of weaponry when you're dealing with different types of animals. You know, I mean, and sure, it's great that, you know, you've never had to use more than three shots, but I mean, you know, again, there's plenty of big bad animals out there that you're going to need more than three shots.
Yeah.
So, you know, but that's a little bit beside the point.
Yeah, we're getting off track here.
Right.
Defending ourselves against the boar attack.
Yeah.
No, it's actually not, though. It's actually not, though. I mean, because when you're talking about gun control, it's not just – There's multiple facets to the argument on why. I mean, you know, I've evolved on this topic, you know, because the reality is where people look at me and say, you should vote for gun control and you need to be about gun control because of where I come from, where I grew up and living in Cleveland and the violence, you know, in the inner city areas that I've been. And what I tell them is like, look, criminals don't follow laws. Right. They don't. Criminals, like, that's the whole thing with crime. Right. If we could get them to follow laws written on paper or written on a sign, then we wouldn't have, you know, 2/3 of the issues that we have. But they don't. Right. I mean, we can't even get people to put on a mask to help other people from catching a disease. So, you know, people, if you write a new gun law, you know, the criminals aren't going to obey it. Right. Like, so ultimately, these gun laws really restrict, you know, legal law-abiding citizens from being able to protect themselves. And this whole idea that I don't need this weapon or I don't need that weapon, screw you. I want whatever I feel, whatever I deem necessary to be able to protect myself and my family, right? And you may want to say, well, you don't need an AR-15 to protect your family. Well, here's the deal. If, let's say, you have a group of, with me being an African-American, let's say you have a group of members from the KKK, or you have a group of white supremacists that decide they don't want me living in my neighborhood that's predominantly white, and they show up at my house, and there's 10 of them, right? Or you have that situation in St. Louis with that couple who came out to protect themselves. Well, a lot of people looked at it like crazy, but look, with the number of people that were there, right. I mean, the guy had an AR-15, and listen, that's the weapon that you want when you're dealing with that many people. Right. Like, so I don't want anyone to tell me what I need or what I don't need. I'll pick it myself. And goddamn it, if I can afford a fucking tank, then I'm going to buy a goddamn tank. Right. I mean, like, that's and there are places where that's OK, other places where it's not. But I think, you know, the Second Amendment is something where the government definitely oversteps their bounds. I think the people calling for gun control are overstepping their bounds, and there's something behind that agenda that makes me very nervous, because we just, history has shown, when you take the guns away, problems arise.
So, Steve, I and the argument you made is completely logical, but I will say, if you're in a helicopter shooting at pigs, magazine size is irrelevant. So if you're going to make that argument, if you're going to make that argument about, I don't want people intruding on my property and outnumbering me, fair. But don't tell me I need to be able to hunt pigs from a helicopter and give me the mags, because those pigs, unless they're incredibly athletic, will not be jumping at your fucking helicopter.
Well, Jim, let me throw this out to you as well, as far as argument for magazine capacity with self-defense and even using an AR. If you start digging into the statistics, and Stephen, I heard you in the last your last podcast talking about, you know, dealing with issues, bringing the facts, bringing statistics, being real with this. Well, if you start digging into it, an AR is better for home defense because it's actually proven to be less likely for over-penetration through walls and through individuals versus a handgun round.
Okay.
So if you go back and you actually look, and I have watched videos, I've done studies on this, you look at interactions of people with handguns, everybody's got Hollywood in their mind. okay, when they think about a shootout and when they think about how people react. You know, guy gets shot one time, he goes flying back 10 feet. That doesn't happen.
Right, sure.
And, you know, go look at shootings that police are involved in. You'll see police fire 33 shots and they hit the assailant 3 times or 8 times or something like that.
Right. I mean, and accuracy, my argument is this. Look, I mean, I'm not a marksman, right? I'm not a marksman, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I'm the most accurate shot there is. I want the thing that's going to be the most efficient killing machine that I need.
Right.
And you're talking about defending myself in my home. And so for me, if I'm more comfortable with the AR doing so, then who are you to tell me, no, I disagree with that. You know, I mean, and I think that because we've had guests on our show come on and say that ARs are not the most efficient weapon and that you should only have a shotgun and maybe a handgun. Right. And we've also had people, Kevin Dixie came on our show and said he was a strong proponent of the AR for home defense along with the shotgun and a handgun, while Mike Wood came on and said, no, you only need a shotgun. And so there's varied opinions on this.
Yeah.
I think that you can find and manipulate statistics to say whatever you want them to say. And so, again, this is a situation where I need the government to stay out of it. If we want to argue about it, that's one thing. But the government coming in and saying what I can and can't have is another. With the gun control thing, I do want to move on and talk about healthcare. And healthcare in and of itself is a broad topic. We're sitting in the middle of a pandemic with COVID-19 right now. We have, you know, the Trump administration actively trying to remove the Affordable Care Act. I try to refrain from calling it Obamacare just because it is called right. The Affordable Care Act. We have the issues that we have with access to healthcare, with the cost of healthcare and insurance. And, Ben, we'll volley it back to you. Where do you come out on healthcare? There's everything from keep things as it is or as they are. There's Medicare for all. And then there's you know, all the different variations in between. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, for me, our family got burned by the Affordable Care Act. We lost our insurance, which we could afford at the time. And in light of how it's gone, we've had to go a very different route. And my personal experience with receiving health care since the passage of that act is it's gotten worse. As well as conversations I've had with friends of mine who are in the medical industry, who are doctors, and they've all talked about how difficult it's gotten under that act. So for me, yeah, heck yeah, repeal it. Because for me, life was a lot better, medically speaking, before that. But I also understand how bad it was for a lot of other people. And in my opinion, you want to talk about breaking up monopolies, like I mentioned earlier, as a role of government. Well, there's health insurance, which basically you've got a handful of health insurance companies dictating, you know, so much of the medical field. And in my opinion, I think it's gotten a little bit worse. I have a little bit of experience since I used to work in medical billing a number of years ago. So I've seen and have experience with how insurance works and all that. But I would like to see government get the hell out of it, basically, for the most part.
So if you anything, wouldn't support the idea of a Medicare or Medicare for all or a single payer system?
I don't. And here's why. It scares the hell out of me because, again, you're putting authority over our medical care under one centralized position in the government. Okay. They've had their chance to run healthcare. Look at the VA. All right. And, you know, obviously everybody wants to talk about, well, look at Canada, look at Great Britain, look at Denmark, look at, you know, other European countries. Okay. But also they're not the U.S. either. And there's a lot of other factors that influence the way things work there. And I've got a number of friends that are in Germany and they despise their healthcare system there. And also they're penalized under a heavy burden of taxes as well. Personally, I would love to see it go to where you get health insurance out of it to the degree that perhaps only you need health insurance for catastrophic reasons. Be able to negotiate individually with your doctor on pricing. I don't want to say, you know, I'm not going this whole make America great again, but almost like what I hear my grandparents and my parents talk about in dealing with doctors, like back in the 1950s, 1960s, hey, went to the doctor, we negotiated the price with them. We didn't have health insurance dictating even then, this is how much you're charged and this is what we allow and this, that, and the other. So they're able to just negotiate directly with the doctor. Now you move on to hospital care and other things. Obviously, it's a very complicated field and there's a lot going on, but just limiting that factor, would we not possibly be able to reduce the cost to a degree that it becomes much more affordable? Am I all for eliminating, like, you know, obviously we have welfare. I truly believe there needs to be a safety net for people in this country. Okay. That's maybe where I break with some of my libertarian friends or the libertarian philosophy on this, but also think it needs to be, I don't say more tightly controlled, but
It does.
There's just so many levels of corruption that go on within welfare that it's ridiculous in the way that system can be abused. So with that, does there maybe perhaps need to be some kind of safety net for people with healthcare? I don't know. I'm open to negotiate. I'm open to talk about that. I don't have all the answers, but my feeling is before we move progressively forward, because, you know, for me, what scares the heck out of me about that is government and control. Then you have, like in England several years ago, the case of Charlie Gard. All right. Kid in the hospital. Are y'all familiar with the case?
I'm not.
Young child in the hospital that I don't remember what specific disease he had, but his parents wanted to be able to bring him to the U.S. to try some different alternative care. The hospital basically said, no, he's ours. We get to say what care he gets, and we say he dies. And they pulled life support on him, and he had to die. They fought it through the court numerous times there in England. And ultimately, it was the healthcare system and the hospital in control, and the parents had no say over what they got to do with their child. And that kind of thing, government control over healthcare, that's what scares the crap out of me. So if we go to a single payer system and we go to universal Medicare, or, you know, health Medicare for all, how can you guarantee me that that kind of thing doesn't happen?
May I?
Jim, go ahead.
So, you're
definitely on the opposite.
I am very much on the opposite side. Yeah. And I respect what you said. I will say that when Sarah Palin said, we're going to have death panels for grandma, I just rolled my eyes and said, you're a moron. Steve and I have fought about calling names in the past. I'm happy calling Sarah Palin a moron. I agree that if government only cared about cost control, then that would scare me. But I personally have a friend who has dealt with the VA in Florida and in the Cleveland area. And they've been very good at some things and very bad at others. I really believe that the profit motive should be taken out of healthcare, period. I have worked almost my entire career in pharmaceutical manufacturing. And you can't take profit out of that and expect companies to innovate. So I'm not this total bleeding heart, let's make everything wonderful and everything should be about, you know, making people happy. Having said that, you know, you deal with government-controlled healthcare issues, which I have personally done as a professional and personally, and I would much rather have a government entity that has rules to follow than a for-profit, obedient to stockholders entity, because if it's all about money, if it's all about what makes, you know, the stockholders happy, then insurance companies are basically a gambling organization that is betting on what's best for us, not what's best for you. And I have personally witnessed both sides of that. I broke my leg 20 years ago and had Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida jerk my chain left, right, and sideways to avoid paying for a bill because I had now moved out of their state and paid for COBRA insurance, which I'm not going to try to defend Bill Clinton right now. It's not a pleasant time to do that. But he was part of the whole putting COBRA coverage in place, which said you could stay covered after you change jobs. And I think the entire concept of your job determines your health insurance is fundamentally fucked up. And the only way I see to fix that is with a national healthcare plan. There may be other options. I'm happy to listen, but I should not change my ability to take care of myself. I'm a single guy. I'm not going to get pregnant. Fuck you, Steve. I love you, brother, but fuck you. But seriously, I mean, I'm a relatively low risk person, although I am almost 50 and my numbers are creeping up. But I think the concept of who I work for determines my ability to have my health care taken care of is flawed. And the only way I see to do that is with a national health care plan.
I don't disagree with you on that at all. Okay. And I totally agree. The system is screwed up big time. Okay. But before we move forward, I mean, I would love to explore that. What does it look like if you take health insurance out of the equation? When you don't have health insurance dictating allowables and prices to doctors, and, you know, doctors deciding, you know, we've had some experiences recently with my grandmother in dealing with her. And basically she had an amputation, and we were told she needed to be able to walk and move right before she was released from the hospital. Next day she was gone. She was out because insurance only allowed for a certain number of days to stay, and she had already exceeded those. So you're gone. And that's where I want to say it's time to get insurance out of the equation to that degree. What would it look like then? Is that possibly where we begin to see enough savings and, you know, that people can begin to afford it?
You know, it's funny. You mentioned three countries. You mentioned England, Canada, and Denmark.
Yeah.
Now, I've spent some time in Canada. I've never been to England. But I used to work for a Danish company. And the Danish company, and I know we didn't make pastries that are delicious in the morning. It's from Denmark. But anyway, you know, I would have lunch with these guys. And I would say to them, like, what do they say about us in Denmark? And the response was, we think you're idiots. Like, we love the fact that we can just, I need to get my teeth cleaned. I go to the dentist. I need to see this, you know, injury on my leg checked out. I go to the doctor. And I said, well, what about the tax level? And they said, oh, taxes are huge. So yeah. That's true. They are. But if you balanced out how much you pay in medical, you know, insurance coverage versus what you were taxed. And this is, I think, Ben, why I'm really excited to talk to you, is that sometimes paying a private industry is not better in my mind than paying the government, because if the government is regulated and you can vote out government officials, you can't vote out Blue Cross Blue Shield. That's why I prefer, especially when it comes to healthcare, a national system. I would have said a state system probably 20 years ago, but now I'll say a national system, because if I lose my job, I shouldn't lose my ability to get my blood pressure medication, get a surgery if I walk down the street and break my leg. And I've done both. Well, I was sliding to third base when I broke my leg, and I was safe, by the way. But you know, I've incurred major medical issues and dealt with the private insurance company that wanted nothing more to do than to fuck me over. And I think that's a garbage system. And I'd much rather put that in the hands of the government and say, put rules in place. You can't take things away from me. I shouldn't have to jump through these hoops just because I went from employer A to employer B.
This for me gets back to argument one. Once you give government that authority and power, yes, we can vote people in, we can vote people out. But how easy is it if it goes south and it goes bad to get government to give up that authority over the healthcare system?
That's legit, that's where I have problems.
And the one thing I'll say, just to interject here as the moderator, that I'm doing such a good job of doing, I think one example of it is, you know, we talk about police reform, right? And we talk about accountability of the police, not being accountable to the communities in which they serve, The unions have too much power. The police chief has too much power. He serves at the at the discretion of the mayor. And so in order to get that back, we the people need to convince the police, the mayor, the chief, the unions that they need to give that, we need to take that power back from them. And it's not easy. It's so difficult that it's literally causing a divide in our country. So if we hand over that level of power to the government with our healthcare and they mishandle it, then how are we going to hold them accountable, right? Like, I mean, because listen, you can vote in, we vote in different mayors all the time and they hire new police chiefs and nothing changes. Things only get worse. Some places, maybe they get better, but you know, with the federal government, it's such a monolithic thing that you're really going to have issues once you hand that power over. And we know that the transition isn't going to be smooth and it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be clean. There's so many different languages that need to be combined. Now, the issue is for me is I don't know where I come out on this. I don't trust the government handling my healthcare because I've seen the government mishandle a lot of things, whether it's the IRS or the VA or HUD or any other federal agency. We've seen them screw things up royally, right? And so I don't necessarily trust them. But at the same time, this COVID situation brought this directly to light for me. You know, seeing people, you know, my neighbors, you know, lose jobs and, you know, lose the access to their healthcare like overnight. And so now what do they do? What happens if they, you know, walk in their dog and something happens? You know, Jim, you had an accident during quarantine, you know, where you banged up your hamstring pretty bad. You know, what if that situation were worse and let's say, you know, the person didn't have a job and the person just hurt themselves trying to take care of themselves, then what do they do? And we know right now the cost of an MRI is thousands of dollars. You know, I just had surgery on my elbow and the total cost of that surgery was close to $20,000. Now I have insurance, it was covered. I only had to pay $3,000 out of that 20, but you know, if I lose my health insurance, then how does that get resolved? You know, do I just have to walk around with a bum arm because I don't have 20 grand in my pocket, or I don't want to incur, you know, a monthly payment, you know, basically an additional car payment, you know? And if I don't have a job, that's where that becomes, it's one thing if you have a job and you're working full time, okay, fine. You know, I can afford to pay $500-$600 a month for a couple of years and get it squared away. But if you lose your job and you have a limited income or no income, you know, or some sort of part-time thing, and something happens, then what do you do?
Well, yeah. If I could jump in, when I broke my leg when I was living in Columbus and I was between health insurance, so literally I left a job on April 30th, which meant my health coverage from my job in Florida ended the end of April. I then rejoined my softball team in Columbus, Ohio, slid into third base and blew my leg up. And my insurance in Columbus didn't pick up until my first day of my first full month of employment, which was June 1st. So I blew my leg up uninsured. I paid for COBRA coverage, honestly, not thinking it would matter, annoyed I did it. And then that happened. And they jerked my chain so badly. They wanted to avoid paying off my, you know, the guy that put me under, I'm drawing a blank on the name of that, whatever. But literally, I didn't want to be conscious when they cut my leg open. And it took months to resolve. And all because of me changing employers. And I think that's bullshit. Now, I will go further and say that for-profit health insurance is just dangerous to begin with. And Ben, what you said earlier actually is something I read in the Ted Nugent book, Ted White and Blue. I read that while sitting in a deer stand. It was raining. I'm in a deer stand reading Ted White and Blue. And he said, of course I did exactly. And I think Ted Nugent's a moron, to be honest with you. But in that book, one of the things he said I actually completely agree with, and that is health insurance should be about everyone pitch in for the normal, pay for services and chip in together for catastrophes. And I completely agree with that. So, you know, if I was paying for routine dental care, routine medical checks, routine whatever, and paying a fair amount to a doctor, but when something catastrophic happened, like I get diagnosed with cancer or shoot myself in the face with a bow, which would be tough to do with Ted Nugent, you'd probably do it. sorry, I'm bad. But, you know, if we just put in a small amount as a team, for lack of a better word, and said, okay, if something really bad happens, we got your back. And then when you want your teeth cleaned or blood work or whatever, you can get that. I'm 100% for that, whether that's government or privately provided. I just don't think privately provided will ever put what's good for people over profit. And
well, go ahead, I'll just share my personal experience with that. I have four children, so insurance can be very costly for us. We've over the years, I've done a lot of math with this, you know, having to maintain a budget and live within means, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So where we are right now is my family is part of a health share program, which basically is like what you're describing. We pay a very small amount each month. If, you know, any medical expenses are under a certain amount, it's out of our pocket. Over a certain amount, then they pitch in and take care of it. But so basically when you go to the doctor, you go with self-pay. And here's what we found. You know, to me, it's this misconception that health insurance equals health care. And I think that's something that's being oftentimes pushed around by certain politicians in the media a little bit. And this is where I get back to my idea, because we go as self-pay. And so then oftentimes we're offered a massive discount by the physician on the services because we're self-pay versus if it was insurance. So I've sat down and figured out if we're paying this month in monthly premium, the kids have got to go to the doctor for this, and we pay our copay here. And then, you know, insurance kicks in and covers this, but then we've got this percentage left over. You add this up over the course of a year, we're forking out a crap ton of money. And if we were to just go with self-pay, and now we're not paying those massive insurance premiums every month that we normally pay, we actually come out on the better at the end of the year. And that's, you know, so getting back to basically how the health share program works, it's kind of like a catastrophic in a way, because it kicks in once it's over a certain amount. And unfortunately, that's what the Affordable Care Act took away, was the ability to have catastrophic coverage if that's what you wanted. And so for guys like you and me, Jim, or even Steve, you know, typically if you're typically not sick in a year, I mean, for me, go to the doctor once a year for a checkup, that's about it. It's very rare that I go for anything else. I've just been, you know, I've got arthritic knees that are absolute shit. And so, yeah, I've had to have those taken care of. But beyond that, I've been fortunate. I haven't had many problems. So something like a catastrophic care would be great. But that right now, that's not an option. And the fact that we're going to think about covering everybody and then up my insurance, or I mean my tax rates possibly, to help cover all that, I don't know. I'm looking at it individually and thinking this doesn't sound like a good deal from my end. As well as just the whole idea of take a look at going as self-pay, and then you start to realize how much insurance dictates how much those costs are, because I'm going to self-pay and now I've get, you know, sometimes a 40% discount off what they would normally be billing the insurance for.
Yeah, so, you know, Ben, if my language has offended you at any point, I apologize. You're clearly a classy guy. I am not.
It's not your language that's offensive.
You can shut your whore mouth, Steve.
No, look, I mean, seriously, I'm not offended by much of anything at all.
I throw F-bombs around all the time. Steve,
nah, you're good.
You know, can kiss my ass. I love you, brother, but fuck you. I'm not apologizing to you for a second. But I hear what you're saying, and this is why I wanted to have a conversation like this, because I don't trust private industry to put profit behind taking care of people. And I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, and please interrupt me if you think I'm being inappropriate, but you don't trust government to do the right thing. And I will fully acknowledge government fucks up things all the time. I'm not delusional about how that gets messed up. Having said that, the especially when it comes to healthcare, I would rather have strict regulations, and I also would not want to put doctors in the tough situation where they run up hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt coming out of medical school. And now I'm about to go ultra liberal on you and say, I want public medical schools to offer strict entry limits to students, but tuition free. I'm not saying totally free. Fuck you, Steve. If you want to go to Harvard Medical School, Harvard private, do your thing. If you want to go to Ohio State's medical school, and the state of Ohio is going to publicly let you do that, your standards for entries should be high, but you shouldn't engage in $500,000 or $250,000 in debt to get there and to be able to practice your profession so that you can't start your job without thinking, okay, if I don't expect you to have 3 MRIs to look at your brain, which happened to me, there's so much incentive to order much. Testing. What's that?
They didn't find much.
Fuck you. All right. I love you, Steve, but I want to punch you, but you're much bigger and stronger than me, and we're 5 miles apart right now. and not necessarily in that order. But no, I seriously think that so much about the industry becomes financial, and when you're under a mountain of debt, you want to do things that get you out of that. And I get it. And I'm lucky enough to have, been a big enough nerd to go to school in West Virginia and get a degree as a chemical engineer and live in the upstairs apartment of my dad's house. So I graduated with no debt, and I'm very lucky for that. But, a lot of these people come out of medical school and other occupations, and they are under a mountain of debt. They're literally paying what I pay for my mortgage every month, and that just fucks up the system. I didn't name you. I know.
I guess, Ben, my question to you is, what's necessarily to stop a doctor from, I mean, like, you've run into doctors that are willing to give you a discount, but what if I'm doing self-pay and I got a doctor who's not, just saying, this is my price and this is what you pay?
Okay. That's where it basically start to, and this is as well to Jim, in that you don't trust government, or you don't trust the private corporation or private industry or business, you don't trust government, but if government runs at all, there's no competition. So if you have a doctor that's not willing to negotiate, chances are within your area, there's usually another doctor you can go to. Am I right?
True, but so a lot of this negotiation has to happen, before the services are rendered, and that's typically not how it goes, right? I mean, unless you're going in and say, okay, if it's this, then this is the price. If it's this, this is the price. And if it's this, which, falls into the catastrophic category, so I guess it's doable. I mean, it's just a foreign concept to me.
I'm not saying it's perfect.
Right. I mean, it's a foreign concept to me, and I've never gone to the doctor. And actually recently I have started to ask questions about the cost of medications and if certain things were covered that were being, assigned to me and asking for actual prices. So, I guess, anecdotally and personally, I can definitely come around on this. I guess my situation where, I injure myself, I go into the doctor, I don't really have time to negotiate price. My arm is hanging off my body, I'm in a lot of pain, and I'm not in the best frame of mind to make a deal. So I think there's
some... only 2/3 of your arm was hanging off your body, by the way.
Fair.
Sorry, one third.
Yeah, I get it for emergency services and things like that. It's a different situation, but for a lot of elective things, as well as just a general doctor's visit, there's stuff you can work out ahead of time. But I think too, if you just let
free market competition.
Ben, you're right. I mean, I get that. And that was the reason why I posed the question, because I wanted to kind of draw that answer out, is the idea of competition. And I think there are some limitations with the idea of free market competition when you're talking about medical emergencies and you're talking about these sort of larger things where, you know, time is of the essence and you don't necessarily have time to shop around.
Right.
But I think it's a good concept, but it's such a foreign thing to me that I really need to, you know, wrap my head around it more on, you know, basically treat, you know, like I just bought a truck. So, I mean, I guess I would need to treat my medical like I did when I went in and buy the truck, like, hey, these are the features and this is what I want, but I'm only willing to pay this price. And I bounced it off at 3 different dealerships until I got the right truck with the right price. And so now we're talking about the same thing with our medical care. And maybe if we were more vigilant about that, even within the system that we have right now, we may be able to see better pricing for people. I think a lot of people get sticker shock with the bills that they get sent, but they also never at any point ask about the cost of anything. It's just, let's just do it because I want to be better now. I want my kid to be better now. And then you get the bill and it's just like, what in the actual hell?
Yeah.
So I think it's something that even in our current system, people need to be more cognizant of. Don't let them just stick you with something and you don't have to just take it. You need to start to push back on pricing. You need to start to push back on services that you don't need or ask for generics and things like that, because you can save yourself a lot of money on the back end. And so that's important. And that doesn't necessarily resolve the overarching issue, because you said something that healthcare and health insurance aren't synonymous. They're not the same thing. But people's access to healthcare is often dependent on their health insurance. And so for many people, those two things are very tightly connected. You know, there's a lot of people who just, you know, lost their jobs and therefore lost their health insurance, and their access to healthcare has been severely limited in terms of, you know, so now there are people, you know, who are not going to go to the doctor and they're going to let some things slide, or they have to think twice about going to the doctor, or the doctors that they can go to are limited in terms of the services that they provide because a person doesn't have the health insurance and the ability to pay like a person like myself would be able to do.
Yeah. And that again, I think gets back to like your situation. If you have catastrophic, then you don't have to worry about that negotiation. Negotiation is more with dealing with your, you know, your day-to-day visits or like you said, elective issues, things like that. You know, you get cancer, you have a heart attack or something like that. That's where let us have catastrophic insurance to cover that. Cause then if so, then I'm freed up from paying the premiums each month for standard insurance that could go to pay those normal bills or other things, you know, as well as, you know, I look at how much I pay in over the course of a year and then how much I actually use it. Kind of like a lot of other insurances, in my opinion, it's one of the biggest scams we got in the country.
You're hitting me where it hurts, because I pay for health insurance and dental insurance.
Yeah.
And I pay $35 a month for dental insurance and I get essentially nothing from it. So I pay almost $450 a year for dental insurance that doesn't even cover a cleaning, because I won't even get into the details of why they won't respond to a phone call, but I get it. And that's why I'm like in the mindset of put this in the government. Let's put rules out there. And I understand distrust of government, but I've been kicked in the nuts by private insurance so many times that, like, why would I trust them?
And that's where you get to the other side of it, too, is, okay, give it to government, but let's look at even examples like the education system. government passes a bill, all right, they provide funding, but those that funding typically comes with strings attached, right?
Sure.
So now here's all these federal forms. Here's all the red tape you have to fill out. I don't recall the number, but I saw statistics one time of how much man hours per year teachers are required in filling out federal paperwork. And that to me, you're going to end up seeing the same thing within the medical system. There's, you're going to end up having, you know, whatever hospital. Now we've got to have extra offices and extra this to deal with the federal government's requirements for this and the government's requirements for this. And I never see government requirements typically get lessened. They usually continue to increase and increase and increase to where are we going to bog down the medical system with it?
You know, Ben, if I'm misquoting you or misstating you, stop me as soon as I do. But I think you put something on Facebook or other social media criticizing the PPP program. Did you do that?
I did. Our business's experience with it. That happened to get corrected today. We were sent some bad information by our bank in the form that you've got to fill out as far as determining what you pay back on the PPP loan. Our understanding going into it was supposed to be 100%, you know, and then we're told we're going to have to pay back 40%. And now that's been switched around because the form they sent us was wrong.
But okay. So I'm with you on that. I'm a independent businessman. I'm a one person company and I've enjoyed working for me because I know I won't fire me. despite my poor job performance. but I get it. And I did a PPP loan and it went from, hey, you can get this forgivable loan to, well, we really don't know what's going to happen. I'm like, well, that's a different thing that was sold to me. Now I put it aside and said, I'm not going to rely on this. I'm going to take what you're offering. And if I need to just throw it right back at you, fine. But you know, you want to give me money, I'll take money. But I think that's a perfect example of where government steps in to try to quote unquote help things. And then, well, we didn't meant to help, but we kind of don't really want to cost money to help. So just do your thing. And I think that's an excellent spotlight on where someone like me, Liberal Jim, will say, step in, government. And someone like you will say, okay, if you're going to step in, at least own what you're doing when you do it, because don't make us jump through hoops and then fuck us over.
Right.
Is that fair?
That's fair. And that's, for me, from my perspective, that's what I see happen with government way too often. And, you know, even down to the local level, I've been involved. I was a guardian ad litem for a year. So I've been involved with social services on the state level. I worked in the state parks. I've seen how that works with the Department of Natural Resources on the state level. So, you know, I've seen levels of government corruption and just the way they love to just bog the system down and everything they get involved with. Start, you know, talk with people in the military about acquisitions and the freaking crap they have to go through just to, you know, to get something changed or get something.
I've never been in the military. I don't know if you have or not.
I have not, but I have a lot of very close friends that have. So I've had some.
I know where you live, so I know how heavily the military involves that area. But I've never been in the military, and I don't like to step on those toes. But but it is a huge part of your neighborhood in South Carolina. And
so, gentlemen, we're at an hour, a little bit over. So I want to go ahead and shut this down. And Jim, we'll start with you. Any closing words? I mean, I think. We got a lot, you know, we covered a lot, and I think we you know, were able to exchange some good ideas. So, Jim, you want to wrap it up?
Sure.
And we'll jump to Ben.
Sure. So, first of all, I want to say thanks, Ben. Like I said, I've never met you in person, but we've interacted a lot on social media. I love the ability to do that, and I appreciate you talking to me. Again, if you put us on paper, we would be very, very different. And we had a good conversation. I enjoyed it very much. If I end up in your neck of the woods, I will invite you out for a beer or a cigar or whatever. And I will look forward to that happening. And, you know, we enjoyed interacting with Whiskey Den, Steve and I did, when we came on your show. So thank you for coming on ours. And again, I enjoyed a civil, logical conversation where we may not be on the same page a lot. We at least had a conversation, and I'm going to sip the last of Manhattan and turn it over to you, sir.
Yeah. I appreciate you guys very much having me on and, getting to sit down and have this kind of conversation, because honestly, with social media, the problem is I don't think this type of conversation happens enough. People share memes and they share talking points from whatever their political side is, and they call each other names, and that's the end of the argument or the discussion. And the reality is, I think if we sit down like this, I think as you and I saw tonight, you can start to find a lot more common ground than you realize is there. And you can find points to agree on, and you find places to compromise. And that's how politics is supposed to work in this country. But unfortunately, right, it doesn't anymore.
And Ben, I also want to thank you for coming on. And you know, that last point you made is something that I'm a firm believer in, is that, you know, our country was built on compromise. You know, no one's going to be completely happy with it, but yeah, it's a way to make things work, and that compromise has to be constant in order for it to continue to go. Any strong shifts in either direction really, you know, causes issues and problems, and, you know, sometimes that's good. Sometimes we need a little bit of a revolution, and I think that's where we're at right now. But eventually, to resolve this, it's gonna require compromise. Not everybody's going to be happy. The loudest voices on the left or the right are not going to be happy with the compromise, but the majority of the people in the middle will be. But it's just going to take everybody in their own neck of the woods being able to sit down and be civil and listen to each other and believe in their ideas, but they need to understand and know what they're talking about when they're having those conversations. And I think we can move things forward. You know, there's a lot of naysayers out there who don't necessarily agree with me and think that we're headed towards a civil war and the end of society. And I don't agree with that. I think there's a lot more good than bad, even though there's a lot of, you know, people with that are lacking information to say. But that'll do it for us. And we appreciate everybody. Again, Ben's podcast and YouTube is The Whiskey Den.
Hi, Whiskey Den.
They review some quality whiskey and some different whiskeys that you may not have heard of. So definitely give them a listen. It's a fun show. And they cover a lot of different things in the world of whiskey. We do our roundtable on Thursdays. Ben, I won't be there this Thursday. I need to mellow out a little bit here. Jim, I will talk to you later. We've got Whiskey Congress, our main thing that we'll do this weekend. But gentlemen, it was fun. And talk to everybody later.
Thanks for moderating, Steve. We'll talk to you soon.
I'm the best moderator. That's why this thing went so well.